from the theme park capital of the world, bringing you the latest in theme park and pop culture news. Welcome to the Thrill Geek Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 50 of the Thrill Geek Podcast. I'm Clint.
Hey, and I'm Barry, and we've got two guests tonight. We'll get to the other one later, but first up, from Haunt Scene, it's Johnny Bronto. For those of you who don't know, I believe Haunt Season started back in 2015, and you, Johnny, have had a pretty crazy experience this year because you decided to hit a ton of haunts for 2018.
Yeah, we went a little crazy. Hello, everybody. I don't know why I just kind of went nuts this year, but we really wanted to get out there and experience as many haunts as possible. So we definitely accomplished that this year.
Is this something normally that you do? Or do you usually plan this out, or is this just like you said? This isn't the norm for you for haunt season.
I think this is the new norm. We started off in Central Florida, just doing the Central Florida haunts, you know, Horror Nights, whatever's open, Shallow Grave, Howl Scream, that kind of thing. And then second season was about the same. Last year we started to branch out to some other areas, and this year we hit up 24 haunted attractions across six states. And
wow.
Yeah, it was a little ridiculous, and we had one major road trip, and I think that's what we're going to do from now on. We're probably going to cover our home base here, and then we'll probably pick a region or two, and we'll go out and see some of the big names in the haunted attraction industry.
Okay, so I know you mentioned to me what were some of the highlights of your insanity this go around? What were some of the haunts that stuck out? They're all incredibly awesome, and I wish I could get out and do some of these more, because sometimes the local haunts are bigger than, you know, they're better than the big events, because they're just the owners put so much love and passion into it than, you know,
money.
Yeah, exactly. So what were some, I know you told me not to mention, you know, what were your favorites, but what were some of your ones that kind of stuck out outside of Florida? I mean, outside of really the Southeast.
Okay. So our road trip was from Florida up to Michigan and back. And I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. And really the goal of going all the way up to Michigan, other than, you know, just seeing family and hanging out in Michigan for a little bit, I had always wanted to do Erebus in Pontiac, Michigan, and I was always there the whole time I lived in Michigan, growing up and everything, since like the early 2000s, I don't remember the exact year, but I never went, and I really wasn't into haunted attractions until I went to Halloween Horror Nights for the first time in 2008, and then I started to get a little addicted. So that was kind of the end goal. Our first stop was Netherworld in Stone Mountain, Georgia, which is in the Atlanta area. And I don't want to say it's a bad place to start, but it is literally walking into like the Disney World of haunts.
Like, oh, really?
It's hard to describe it. Haunt porn comes to mind. Like, it is the most detailed, over the top. Visually, you can't even fit it in. Like, your brain doesn't have enough hard drive space to really process it. It was amazing. They've got two haunts there: The Awakened and Project Unknown. This is multi-million dollar, big name haunt stuff. That's why
I was going to say they've been around for a while, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just so good. And they had the escape rooms there as well. And they were like little mini haunted attractions, and you were escaping from them. So it was amazing. So that was, we really started off at like the top of the mountain, as far as like, you know, the level of detail and everything with the haunt. But we got to experience all kinds of different stuff. Like every little haunt that we did a total of six from here to Michigan and back. And every one had its own little personality and brought something different to a different experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's haunts that are, I don't know what I'm trying to say here. There's ones that stand out more than the others as far as size.
Right.
And then there's ones that are, you know, the more intimate experiences. Did you experience any ones that were a surprise to you that going in you weren't expecting a lot but were pleasantly surprised?
You know what? I've actually got two, and I've got both ends of that. I've got one that I was legitimately scared of.
That was going to be awesome. That was going to be another one I was going to ask you. Is there something that legit?
well, let's do the surprise first.
Okay, we'll
so
start there.
I've gotten to know a lot of haunted attraction owners and a lot of haunters and scaresters. Obviously, with what we do, you're going to network with people.
Sure.
And originally, the only one that we were going to do in Michigan was Erebus. But Sylvia, who used to be formerly of a Petrified Forest in Altamont Springs, she recommended a independent haunt that's called Hush Haunted Attraction. It's a Westland, Michigan, and it's just one of those ones that I didn't even know it was there. And we went there, and I'll be honest, it didn't look like much from the outside, but mm-hmm. once we got in, it was really cool. It was really, really well done. Those guys did a really amazing job. They probably got me more like jump scares, startle scares, than a lot of other haunts that I did this year. So I got to give some shout outs to the big surprise. I called it like a hidden gem in Michigan, Hush Haunted Attraction. So it was really good.
That's awesome.
As far as scary goes, if that's the next question, there is one that is in, I'm going to say it wrong, Pataskala or Pataskala. It's in Ohio, kind of in the Columbus area, and it's infamous. It's called the Haunted Hoochie at Dead Acres. And
that's an interesting name.
Yeah, it's like the haunter's haunt. Like, you know, when I would talk to different haunt owners and really hardcore haunt enthusiasts, they would always refer to Haunted Hoochie. Gotta do Haunted Hoochie, gotta do Haunted Hoochie. And Melissa and I were there, and I guess maybe we had built it up in our minds to the point of we had pretty much accepted the fact that we were going to die in this haunt.
This is it.
Yeah, this is it. And, you know, we actually had a conversation, and we went, and it was pretty, you know, starting, it's fall up there, so it was pretty cold. And that haunt is just, it's in your face, man. That's the most extreme, ridiculous thing I've ever done in my entire life. And it was amazing. And I said this on my show, but once you're about, like 30 seconds in and you realize that you're not actually gonna die, that's when you can just embrace the madness and just enjoy it.
Is this one of those ones that they can like physically grab you?
Yes.
I mean, do you have to sign a waiver and type stuff?
Well, no waiver, but they can grab you.
They can grab you. And
somebody full on grabbed Melissa's ankle, and she felt like she was dragging them for a couple feet.
Oh my God.
I don't know if it was a leaf blower or a chainsaw, but I definitely got poked right up Main Street with something.
Yeah.
And some of the visuals in there were pretty crazy, man.
Hello.
Yeah, it was definitely a little woo-hoo moment. But they're all, you know, they've got like a cage dancer. They've got all this crazy like imagery on this projection, and they got all the signs all over the place. Really, the point of Haunted Hoochie is they're really big on like free speech, and they definitely put it out there. It's completely different. Like, if you've ever done any sort of like extreme type haunt, multiply that by 10 or 100. That's Haunted Hoochie.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean their website alone looks nuts.
Website looks like a Rob Zombie fan site on crack.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing, I guess. Yeah, but it was cool. It was one of my prized possessions. They sell a t-shirt and on the back it says I survived Haunted Hoochie, and then in parentheses, but it was hell. So that was like my badge of honor for that one. So shout out to those that crew, cuz it was amazing.
So is it like one? Is the theming of the Haunted Hoochie house like one theme, or is it just like?
Well, it's got different stuff in there. Like, it's got like your big animatronics, you know, your dragons and your evil creatures and all that stuff. It's more of like a I don't know, like a rockabilly, hillbilly, Polk County gone wrong type thing on crack. Well, I live in Polk County, so I guess I can make fun of that.
Yeah,
but it's kind of that I wouldn't call it like country, but it's like that.
Okay,
you know, yeah, that kind of thing.
I got you. Yeah,
but it was I saw some crazy stuff in there, and it's they start you off in one scene, they run you through like cattle. I mean, they put in like 10 people at a time. They basically run you through the whole thing, so you're in a group, and then you stop, and there's a little scene, and then it's like hell getting from one section to the next.
Yeah.
And then finally, it's done, and it was a wow. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Ohio, you also got to visit Cary, Ohio.
I did.
While you were up there. Tell us about that. Did you experience anything interesting up there as far as, you know, do they, I don't know, I've never really read up on Cary, Ohio, the actual location, so.
I did when we were on our way.
Yeah.
I went in, like, I totally, like, Wikipedia'd it on the way. It's a very small town.
Yeah.
You know, it's super small, and I was shocked when I got there. We, you know, Melissa and I got out, we stopped by like the city sign and we took pictures, and we're sitting in front of like the city sign, like Village of Cary, Ohio, and right across the street there's like this big motorcycle enthusiast club or a motorcycle club or something like that, like a bunch of bikers like just staring at us. I was like, well, this is a little weird. So we kind of hastened that a little bit, and then we stopped in like the dead center of town, right in between the municipal building and the post office, and just started taking pictures. Like we were in full tourist mode.
Yeah.
And it was Saturday. It was like a Saturday, like around noon, like around lunchtime. And I just wandered into the police station because we were taking pictures of like the police cars, you know, like Cary, Ohio. By the way, the one that they had at the Shady Brook, the scare zone for 25 was like dead on. It's like,
oh really?
Copy paste. Yeah, it was really cool.
That's cool.
So we go in, you know, and it's funny because I walk into the police. They got like a little glass window. And I'm like, hey, man, you know, we're going to take some pictures. You know, we're not weird or whatever. And the cops, the police officers, the fine police officers of Cary, Ohio, actually came out and talked to us.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
They had like this little like thing, and it had like pencils and stickers and all the stuff for Cary, Ohio. And I stole like half of it. And they came out and talked to us for like a good 15, 20 minutes, just telling us about the town or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was shocking because the vast majority of people that we talked to had no idea that the town was such a celebrity to us down here in Florida.
Really?
Yeah, and we did a live stream, and even I still, to this day, even though it was a couple weeks ago, I still get responses to the live stream we did there, and a lot of people ask, why were you here? Why were you here? Why were you here? And everybody apparently in Cary, Ohio knows that we were there all of a sudden, so I guess we've got a lot of fans in Cary, Ohio. So hello, my Cary, Ohio peeps.
That's crazy, because that was one thing I was going to ask you, was like, is there any recognition of the people that live there? Do they know about, you know, the history that their city has with Horror Nights?
Nah, I mean, some people have a little bit of an idea, or they know somebody that knows it or whatever. Like one of the police officers said that one of the other police officers that wasn't working was really hardcore into it and visited every year.
Yeah.
But not a lot of people, because we were in full gear. We had our haunting gear on, and we went to lunch at, God, what was that place called? Splinters or something like that. I don't remember what it was called. And we went, and we were talking to the people there, and we were like, you know, we're just BSing. And it was kind of cool because they have all these flyers up for Scary Cary, which is like a local Halloween event there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I'm sure it's like a, you know, community type thing, but one of the posters or one of the storefronts was a scary clown, and it was so perfect. But it was like a rainbow kind of like Ronald McDonald type clown, but I thought that was hilarious.
That's awesome. So yeah. you guys went up there to Ohio, and did you hit any haunts on the way back from your trip, or was it
Yes, we did Netherworld, and then we went to Columbus on the way heading north. We were going to just do Haunahoochee, but we found out that there's actually a 13th floor location. Like, we have one in Jacksonville here, but there's one in Columbus, Ohio, that was a relatively retooled haunt, and they had actually purchased another haunt. 13th floor actually owns like 16-ish haunts all over the U.S., so it's kind of like a chain, I guess.
Yeah.
And we just figured, because we had a network with the one in Jacksonville, that person put us in touch with the person that runs 13th floor in Columbus, and we were able to go and experience it. And it was fun. And it was a way to kill a couple hours before we sat in line for Haunahoochee for a little while. But we actually hit Cary on the way back from
Michigan. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was our first stop on the way back. And then we hit one other one on the way back, which was called the Dent Schoolhouse in Columbus. And it's also one of those like famous big name type haunts. Yeah.
Did you Gosh, I forgot what I was going to ask you now. Oh, aside from Haunted Hoochie, which sounds like it was pretty insane, is that the most intense house you've ever been through your obsession with haunted houses, or is there one that hasn't been beat for you yet?
Haunted Hoochie was definitely the craziest thing.
Yeah.
But maybe it's modeled a little bit after Haunted Hoochie. Previously, we had a haunt that was here. Last year was its last year, unless it comes back. But the Shallow Grave in Winter Haven was pretty legit as far as solid scares and everything there, really in your face. And also this year, the Ominous Descent Trail at Sir Henry's Haunted Trail, that one is also really intimidating and in your face as well.
That was another question I was going to ask you. I know I wanted to talk to you a lot about your out-of-state stuff, but do you have any recommendations for haunts here in Florida that people could visit? Because obviously probably our biggest listening audience is here in Orlando with the theme parks. But, you know, outside of Orlando, further south in the didn't you go down to
We went down last weekend
to Miami or something.
Boca Raton, which is like one of the last big cities before you hit Miami.
Okay.
And West Palm Beach as well.
What was down there as far as
if it, speaking of recommendations in Boca Raton, there's Enigma Haunt, and it's a better part of 3 hours away, but it's absolutely amazing. It's totally worth the trip. Everybody who's gone there. Friends of mine, other type reviewers, they have all had a good time. Really great characters, really great people running it. It's a blast. They have some of the best cue actors, a lot of people to interact with. Some haunts you just show up and do them, and they're pretty and they're scary, but it's you're focused mainly on the haunt experience. But I think a lot of people forget that there's also an entertainment side of it, like a whole package. And there's a lot to do, a lot to interact with at Enigma.
Yeah, because there's been haunts that I've gone through that are, aside from being, you know, absolutely terrifying, you actually forget to take in the theatrics of some of these haunts. Yeah. Because they're actually trying to put on a show. They're actually trying to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, a lot of the people that go through these haunted houses miss that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the really cool parts about some of these haunted attractions is there's a story there if you pay attention.
Yeah, and I will admit, from a haunt goer, haunt enthusiast perspective, go to the website, you know, read the story. You get so much more out of the haunted attraction. Not every haunt is created equal, but some of them have pretty elaborate backstories, or even their tickets. They'll have the story on the ticket, or they'll have a TV screen that tells you a little bit more about the story, and you can get a little more oomph out of the haunt if you know what's going on.
Yeah, that's always a good tip, because even if you, like I said, even if you can't, you go through these haunts, and some people, they get so terrified they completely miss the point of the haunted house if there is a story there. If you go and you read the backstory, if there is one, I think that always helps out in some of these haunted attractions in providing just a little bit more better of an experience. You know, it's just like anything. You know, if you go in with a little bit of information, you're gonna enjoy it a little bit better. So
yeah, and you know, it's nice to know that the first character you come across at, let's say, Ominous Descent, is Wade Harris, who's one of their main characters there, and he has a role in the whole story and getting corrupted and all kinds of stuff. Instead of just seeing creepy butcher guy, you know, it's like, knowing a little bit more is always beneficial when you're doing haunted attractions.
Yeah, sure. Barry, you got anything for Johnny you wanted to?
I mean, what are some? I'm trying to think the ones I haven't done before. I mean, we have. Here, I mean, we have a Petrified Forest.
Loved it.
You know, and I mean, the interesting thing to me about that one is how they manage to change that up every year, even though it's pretty much the same trail that you're going on.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about their build, but they always do something amazing every single year, and how they remix the themes and how they added. Did you guys both do Petrified Forest this year?
No, I don't think I did not.
I haven't done it this year, unfortunately. Okay. I mean, Clint's been to Screamageddon, and I just have outside of Hallow Scream. I have not been able to do much this year because I got married. So,
well, okay then.
And I got three kids, and I'm married.
Gotcha. Well, a Petrified Forest is really, really neat. They put on a good show. I've never had a bad time at a Petrified Forest. They actually used a little bit of technology this year, which was really cool. In their haunted house, they have these little like lanyards they give you with like a little microchip on it, and it's got a light on it. And as you go through the different haunt, through what they call the Z-TAC, the different characters in the haunt can hit you and like make your light blink, like you can die basically. And other characters in the haunted attraction in that trail can heal you, so it's a little bit more incentive there, and it was a blast.
Interesting. That was one other question I was going to ask you about the future of haunts. What are some of the big things that are coming up that you see, that you've noticed going through some of these more recent haunts? Is there a certain technology or a certain anything that you see becoming a bigger thing in 2019 in haunts, whether it's a certain type of technology or just the way that people do haunted houses? What do you think is going to be big for 2019 as things wind down here in 2018?
You know, things like that Z-TAC thing, I think it's pretty cool, you know. Yeah. Where there's incentive, any sort of even it's not really technology, but there are, like, if you've been to Screamageddon, you know how they do the glow necklaces?
Yep.
Where you can get a more intimate or more extreme experience. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think we're going to see a little bit more of that because that seems like it goes over well. There are some trends I'd like to see go away because I've seen a lot of, and no offense to any haunt out there in any way, shape, or form, but man, I've seen a lot of UV houses and a lot of 3D houses, a lot of fluorescent clowns.
Yeah.
No offense to any of you, but I have to remind myself that I'm a special case because we make an effort to go out through and do an excessive amount of haunts.
Yeah.
So obviously we're going to see some themes over and over and over again.
Yeah.
There's, you know, I mean, there's only so much you can do with horror. I mean, I could probably write down 20 different themes in horror, and that's about all you can really do. So I get it, but you know, and that's a personal bias, because when I walk into a house and it's like 3D, my brain just shuts off.
Yeah.
It's just like, all right. Like, no offense to Screamageddon, but, you know, they had their Bedlam 3D last year and they had Rage 3D this year. And it was just like,
it was like a dance party this year. I didn't quite understand it either. You know, and I completely get where you're coming from with the whole 3D thing. And, I think to me personally too, I've just never found those types of houses scary.
Yeah. Some people do though.
Yeah. I think it's a personal preference really with those 3D funhouse type mazes. There's some parts that are cool. Like, you know, I'll walk through them and I'll be like, oh, that's a cool effect.
Yeah. Some of the 3D's actually like really, really good.
Yeah. There's some haunts I've seen where, you know, the 3D, they really get creative with the black light paint and, you know, do all sorts of crazy stuff. But you know, it's interesting because, you know, if I didn't have three kids, wife, married, house, you know, I've always been, we didn't do it this year just due to lack of us finding more helpers. I helped build our local haunted house here in Hunter's Creek. We called it Hunter's Creep Nights. And, so that was kind of my dabble into building a haunt. And, you know, so that stuff is always fascinating me, the construction side of a haunt, the design aspect of a haunt. Has it ever been something for you to want to do something like that? I don't know you enough to, are you one that would want to go out and do your own haunt one day? Or are you just here to experience everybody else's?
those are two competing things, because the moment if I were to ever commit to being associated with a one individual haunt, that means I can't go out and do all the haunts. So
that's true, yeah.
And it's like, I want to be a scare actor at Halloween Horror Nights, but then that would limit my ability to go out and do other things.
True.
But the industry is absolutely fascinating. Once you get past the, you know, the political side of it and some of the stuff that happens behind the scenes, it is just so fascinating to me,
yeah.
You know, to learn to peek behind the curtain and learn how things work, why people or why things are the way they are. Like I didn't really understand why, like laser swamps. You know how they have like laser swamps where they got the fog. And they got, like, the laser, and it looks like you're walking through something like that.
Oh, yeah, it's like a flat laser, and you shine fog through it, and yeah.
Like, I'm like, why are all these green? Like, I was asking somebody last night, we did Neverending Nightmare in a Koei, and I asked the owner, I was like, why are those things always green? And, you know, he basically explained that shows up the best and usually fits more themes than doing, like, a red or a blue or something like that. But just little stuff like that, like how lights work, how sound is fed through a haunt. Mm-hmm. And I've picked up a lot, and it's really opened my eyes to look at haunts a different way.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the trade-off of knowing how things work takes away a little bit of the scare factor.
Oh, I completely agree. Because I worked at Halloween Horror Nights for several years. I can't I can't think the exact number right now, but you know, when you do those things, whether you become a scare actor or you know you do some kind of technical stuff, like whether you're a lighting guy or you know some of the behind the scenes stuff, it can put a damper on you know you going back and experiencing haunted houses because you kind of figure out how stuff works.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a little bit of a bummer, but like you said, on the flip side, it's also really fascinating to see how this stuff works and, you know, some of the behind the scenes stuff. I wish we had a big haunt convention here in Orlando.
I do too. There is one in Ocala. It's called, CHEC, Southeastern Haunted Enthusiast Convention. It was like late spring or early summer, maybe June or something like that.
Okay.
We can probably talk about that a little bit more off the air, but
yeah,
you know, it's a place for haunters to come in and BS. I went to Transworld this year, which is like, you know how we have IAPA?
Yeah.
It's like basically IAPA for haunters, and they've got that. They got Midwest Haunters Con, Haunt Con. So there are things like that. It's just, unfortunately, it's not here in Orlando, Central Florida.
Have you ever been out to Midsummer Scream out on the West Coast?
I have not been to that one yet. I want to make a trip out there. California's always been a place I've wanted to visit. I want to do Horror Nights out there. I want to do Knott's Scary Farm. Yeah. Melissa went out there this year. She covered. She got some experience with that, but I've always wanted to go.
Yeah, I wanted to do it the last time we were out, but we had so much to do at Disneyland that we just, you know, I didn't have time to sneak over to Knott's because I hear so many good things about Scary Farm. So, are you a big Halloween guy aside from haunt stuff? Obviously Halloween is your holiday, but what do you with Halloween coming up here? Do you got any plans or what's normally your agenda for Halloween? Haunts or?
After last night, we're done for the season for haunts, but I'll probably be at Horror Nights. it's you can't really beat it. You know, spending your Halloween at the Halloween capital of, you know, Florida, basically. Yeah. So I'll just go. I'll kind of hang out. Plus, you know, it's always the home stretch, and you realize at the last minute, you're like, oh, crap, Horror Nights is ending. I better go more. Because, you know, I've been taking a lot of time off because, you know, it's hard to do all the haunts we do and want to go to Horror Nights when it's available. It's just too much.
Yeah, completely understand. I wish I could get out and do more haunts, you know, but again, falls back on, you know, me, married, kids. Because, you know, I'm, as everybody sees on Twitter and stuff, Halloween is my holiday.
Yeah,
I would love to get out and experience more haunts. You know, who knows? Maybe when my oldest Jordan, he gets old enough to do these sorts of things, he can, you know, we can go on some more road trips and do some more things. So, 'cause Halloween is my my mecca. I loved your meme the other day with Hodor.
Yeah.
With all the Christmas stuff.
Well, I mean, that's a weird thing here. And Christmas has always been weird to me in Florida because it's always sunny out every day. Like, we don't get snow. So when I start seeing, like, Christmas trees and Christmas music and yeah. candy canes on light poles, I'm like, this I'm from is so weird.
I'm from upstate New York, so yeah,
I'm from Detroit, so
I completely yeah. I can completely understand your frustration and confusion, because like I was at SeaWorld with mm-hmm. with my two boys, and you know today was the last day for Halloween Spooktacular, and they've got the sea of trees up ready to go, and they've got the ice skating rink up. I was like, it's that weird time in Florida.
Yeah,
Halloween's ending and every park is getting ready for Christmas. So,
I mean, you're probably like me. Halloween's like my New Year's.
Yeah.
I live and die by the Halloween Horror Nights schedule. When Halloween Horror Nights ends next Saturday, that's literally like my New Year's Eve.
It's like, see you next year.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I basically call this time of year from, I guess, well, now since Disney started in mid-August until New Year's, basically Hallow Thanksmas.
Yeah.
And it's my favorite time of the year. The last basically 3 months of the year is just, it's just, you know, from Halloween to Christmas to all this, it's just nonstop. I don't get that much rest during this time of year.
Yeah.
I give everybody a lot of, you know, it's all in good fun. I give everybody a lot of flack about, you know, the Christmas season coming. But you know, I'm excited for it. I love the holiday season, but Halloween is my baby. And,
yeah.
As you guys saw on Facebook and Twitter, I'm busy getting my front yard set up.
I saw that. That's cool.
Yeah. I got my little ghost all set up, kind of inspired from Trick or Treat. I built those literally like within the last week. So, I'm that house in my neighborhood. Everybody comes and, you know, which sucks because I have to buy like exponentially a lot more candy than everybody, because eventually the word gets around that I have this cool house for Halloween, and the troves of people just come to my house.
That's cool.
So, you know, it's fun. I love it. I get out there and I run around and I scare people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's always a good time. Halloween, you know, my dad, it started when I lived at home with my dad. You know, we'd go out and we'd do all sorts of crazy stuff in the front yard. And, you know, now that I got a place of my own, I get out and do it. So I love it. I love the spooky season. So
I do too. I remember when I was a kid, we didn't have a lot of money. So they'd always take us trick or treating in like the nice neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Like they would like outsource their trick or treating, and we would go and like, if the person was giving away full-size candy bars, we would always like rotate costumes and hit that house up like five times.
Like, that's the house right there.
That's it. It's
that's the good Snickers. House.
Full-size Butterfinger. Make it happen.
I wish I could do that. But again, like it starts off kind of every year. I've noticed since we've been at this house, and I've been, you know, kind of noted as that guy that does the crazy Halloween decorations. It starts off slow, but by usually about 8:30, 8:45, it gets crazy at my house. And, you know, I usually have my parents come over and help out, hand out candy, because, like I said, I'll dress up and I'll run around and I'll scare people.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a good time. I love it. So it's a nice send-off, because I know November 1st, the Christmas music will be playing.
That's fine. That's fine. And all the Halloween stuff will be 50% or 70%
exactly.
off.
Yep. So you know, it's fun to have a fantastic Halloween. So, fun question. Favorite Halloween candy. This is for both Barry and Johnny. So,
oh God.
Favorite Halloween candy.
Reese's.
Oh, cups or pieces.
So good.
Not the cups. The like different.
There's so many different Reese's variations
now. I actually like all the different seasonal versions that are like, you know, like Christmas you have like the trees or stuff like that, or
the pumpkins.
You have the pumpkins or the eggs. I like those more than I like the cups.
Yeah.
So I literally, once that candy goes on sale after each holiday. From like Halloween, Christmas, Valentine's, and Easter, I like stock up on all the specialty stuff because I actually like those better than I like the regular Reese's cups.
Nice.
Did you figure it out, Johnny?
Yeah, I gotta be all about the sugar rush, man. Like, give me Smarties, give me Nerds.
Okay,
that's straight up sugar, I'm all about.
The Pixie Sticks.
Oh yeah.
Just dump the sugar in and just go.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was at, speaking of which, I was at, me and the wife, we were at Big Lots today, and all their Halloween stuff's 25% off, and Home Depot was already 50% off of their Halloween stuff. Too. Yeah, so the Halloween sales are starting, so time to stock up, so, cool. Well, I think that was it. Barry, was there anything else you wanted to ask Johnny while we had him on here, or?
No, I think we covered it.
Yeah, I just wanted to get on, you know, chat some spooky stuff, some Halloween stuff. So, because this, you know, our 50th episode ended up falling on Halloween week, so
that's cool.
Perfect timing. So, Johnny, thanks so much for taking time out of your evening. I know you were tired.
No problem.
Get some rest and enjoy these last few days of spookiness at Halloween Horror Nights, and maybe we'll see you out there.
Yeah, I probably will. Just make sure, you know, everybody listening, because this is a selfless plug part.
Yeah, no, go. Have it.
Make
have
sure
it
hit up HauntScene on social media, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, HauntScene.com. We got our Haunt directory there in case you're looking for something to do. Maybe get a little bit of planning done for next year. Watch the show. We do, during the Haunt season, we do a live episode every 8 o'clock every Tuesday. We got two episodes left. We got an episode on Tuesday this week. It's like kind of our wind down episode, and then the following Friday we have our drunk edition, which is like our season finale, so we'll get trashed, have some special guest stars, and talk about some fun stuff. And then I really want to be more active in the off season, so I'm sure we'll get up to some adventures here and there.
So pretty much everything social media is Haunt Scene, right? At Haunt Scene on Twitter,
Haunt Scene everything,
Haunt Scene Facebook,
Haunt Scene, Okay Cupid, farmersonly.com, Match.com. I don't care. Just Haunt Scene everywhere. Just find us. I'd appreciate everybody checking us out.
And if you see him in the park, sometimes he has really cool Haunt Scene buttons with his little ghost logo, which I love, by the way.
Yeah. We'll be clearing them out. I got lanyards and I got buttons. We'll be clearing them out. So I'll definitely be at Halloween Horror Nights on Wednesday, and I'll probably be there this next weekend
and
as well.
Speaking of buttons, I have to thank you personally because the Thrill Geek buttons we've been handing out were from the same website where you get yours. So
yeah, Pure Buttons.
Pure Buttons, yeah. So a little plug for them. If you want some cool buttons, head there. And everybody's been loving them. So
buttons are awesome. They're cheap and they can give. Yeah, people love them.
Yeah. So I thank you again for hooking me up with them because that was awesome. So
I'll help anybody. If anybody needs any help, you let me know. I've stumbled through everything for the show. So
yeah. Cool. So, all right, Barry, let's you can get us out of here.
All right, man, thanks. And now if one guest wasn't enough for our 50th episode, we have two. Our next guest is John Massari. He's a TV and film composer. And why did we interview him? Well, he composed the music to Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which is now a scare zone at Halloween Horror Nights. And he came out to see this scare zone of this cult movie that he composed the score for and has become well known for. I mean, he started his career on Little House on the Prairie doing music for that way back in the early 1980s. And he's been responsible for all kinds of different TV shows and film, even doing music for The Wonderful World of Disney. But his big claim to fame is doing the score for two cult classics. One is The Wizard of Speed and Time, and the other one, of course, is Killer Clowns from Outer Space. So he was nice enough to take time while he was out here visiting to see the Killer Clowns scare zone to sit down with Clint and myself for a conversation about his career and about Killer Clowns from Outer Space.
So, John, I mean, one of the things I want to look back on is when did you first get interested in music and composing?
It started when I was very young. When I would say My mother had bought a piano for herself to learn how to play piano, and I went to a I was 6 years old, and I went to my first triple feature matinee, and it was the Journey to the Center of the Earth, The Mysterious Island, and let me see, what's the last one? And The Time Machine. And I was absolutely floored by everything, every aspect of it. And I had no idea that what was, it wasn't until later I realized what was really affecting me was the music, because I started planking on my mom's piano. And it's interesting, some of the things I remember, some of the first thing plinking that I remember, and I actually used it as material. And, you know, I expanded when I learned more about how to, when I became more competent in creating music, I used those little plinkings, you know, and one of them is in Killer Clowns from Outer Space. That, but anyways, because I just used to go by like white key to black key and things like that. And then, oh, that made an interesting sound. And then when I learned how to notate and, you know, dream up music and then notate it, because you know, some people kind of do it the other way around. They get very literal and calculated with music, where it was me, it's like, is this sounding right? And then I'll write that down. And then in reading biographies of the great masters, that's exactly how they did it. They didn't go to a pencil and paper or pen and ink, you know, while they were writing. They came up with something that really worked, and then they started writing that down. You know, it's like you've got thoughts. You collect your thoughts, and then you write the thoughts down. It's basically that work. But it was that early on that I had a love for music, and I could never, you can never tear me away from the hi-fi system. Because back in those days, we had like a cabinet. It was like a piece of furniture with two big speakers in it and a turntable. And I used to wake up in the middle of the night, probably 3 or 4 in the morning, and click on the FM and go through the channel. And then my parents finally gave me a little AM radio. AM FM radio. In my bedroom, I would just listen to it all night, constantly turning channels, listening to different music. And we lived not too far from, and this is in Southern California, we lived not too far from a place called Knott's Berry Farm. Now, Knott's Berry Farm, kind of like not too far from Disneyland, they had a lot of country western artists perform there. And I saw Chet Atkins and Buck Owens. And, you know, you say what you want about country music, you had to be, these were really great musicians. And to see Chet Atkins, a guitar player, like, you know, 10 feet away from me playing, to me, my jaw would just drop. I was fascinated that he was making music, and I was watching it, and just, and I had a thing for guitar.
Yeah.
But I never learned how to play guitar. I never got a guitar because we had a piano. Yeah. You want to learn an instrument? We have a piano. Your mom doesn't want to play it, but if you want to be, there it is. And so I used to make pretend guitar from a ruler and string some rubber bands across it and just play with the, you know, pretend. But anyways, so the keyboards became my main instrument. And then from there, I learned how to play the contrabass and French horn and trumpet and percussion instruments and what have you. So it started at early age.
How did you get into TV and film composing? I looked through your list. It goes all the way back to Little House on the Prairie, I believe. The old Wonderful World of Disney, right. Stuff like that. How did you end up getting into stuff like that?
Okay, let me qualify the old Wonderful World of Disney. In IMDb, they have like every permutation of the Wonderful World of Disney theme, going back to 1957. I was born in 1957, so I didn't. So the permutation of the version that I did was in 1987.
Yeah.
1987. And so how did I get that? Oh, my goodness. You point to any credit, I can give you a diagram of how I got there. It's not just out of the blue that it happens. So what I did was let's start with like Little House on the Prairie. I was out of college. I was studying orchestration from a man named Dr. Albert Harris privately. In addition to going to UCLA studying there, I took lessons privately because I was constantly running into people that, as far as I was concerned, they were raising the bar. You know, I would be comfortable at a certain level. I go, yeah, yeah, I'll just do this kind of music. It's great. And then I'll see someone else that's like, blows me out. How did you learn how to do that? Well, I did this, that, and I also studied with Dr. Albert Harris, right? Well, Dr. Albert Harris also taught a lot of famous people. Among them, James Newton Howard was one of his pupils. I didn't know James Newton Howard at the time, and I don't think he was as popular when I studied with Dr. Albert Harris. But when you study with this guy, if out of nowhere, I didn't really know this, if he thought you were good enough, he'll give you a couple of phone numbers. He'll call these two people. They need some help. Because they're looking for someone new that, you know, is willing to work for not a lot of money and who's really good, really competent. So he said, here, you call these two guys, David Rose and Jerry Fielding. Jerry Fielding did a lot of Clint Eastwood movies, and David Rose did Little House on the Prairie, Bonanza, and all this. Both of them were, like, basically my grandparents' age. Well, excuse me, David Rose was 82. Jerry Fielding was not yet 60. But to me, being a 24-year-old, they seemed very, very much ahead. Well, Jerry Fielding would be like an older dad, and David Rose was definitely like grandpa. And both of them like were really tough on me. You know, my first meeting is they basically gave me some stuff to go in the next room and let me see what you come back with. Like then, right then and there, let me see what you can do right here in front of me. And this is the situation, and you know, what can you, so like an hour or so later, you know, I come back with something to play. Okay, this, I think we can work together. And so with David Rose in particular, I would do like little tiny things, like transitions, like 10 seconds, 15 seconds long, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then I would watch to see how he did things, right? So when I got good enough after a while working with both of those guys, well, Jerry Fielding had passed away, and David Rose was on his way to retire. So then I just would make a... Now, back in those days, there was, if you were in the musicians' union, you literally had everyone's phone number, home phone number. Yeah. So I would call, like, Bill Conti, and I would say, hi, I'm... introduce myself, and he'd sit there. Unheard of today. Who would call out of the blue, and you would be on the phone for 3 minutes?
Yeah, it feels like to me when I look back at the industry back then, mm-hmm. it was smaller. It was a smaller community, and like you said, if you had the right if you had the right teacher, mm-hmm. you met the right person, then all of a sudden it opened up all these doors that right. It's very different than it is now.
Right. You had to make more of a personal face-to-face contact, or you had to get a reference. Whereas now, I mean, people can hear about your work. I hear about a lot of really talented young people that I work with via social media. You know, that's just the way it is, because now there's such a huge volume to choose from. But anyways, I remember calling Bill Conti, and it was very interesting because he had seen me twice, and then I made the suggestion, you know, just to talk. He went through his whole story of how he got in the business, which was like, to me, like, wow, talk about climbing up a sand berm. To get where you are today, that's like incredible. So he had an amazing resilience to get where he was. And by that time, when I met up with him, he had just finished The Spy, For Your Eyes Only, one of the James Bond movies. So mm-hmm. he had not just Rocky, but several things, you know. And before Rocky, he had done quite a volume of work before he got to Rocky. And so the second meeting, or second or third meeting, I made the suggestion. He goes, do you think it's possible that I can orchestrate for you? And he laughed so loud, like if he had heard the funniest joke in the world. And then when he recovered, he says, you're really funny. I really like you. I tell you what, you call me every like couple of months. Tell me where you're at, and I'll give you some pointers and things like that. And so I said, well, what about orchestrating with you? And he goes, I can afford the best guys in the world. Yeah. There's these two guys in England that work for me, and there's a guy, there's three or four guys here. What do I need to hire you for? Yeah. I can basically scratch something on paper, and they will blow it out into a gorgeous thing. You know, he was the one that told me, he says, you got to find out where your strengths are, you know, because there are some people, not him in particular, because he was very classically trained. He was very, very accomplished, very fine musician, and kind of like, you know, I want to say like the same school as John Williams. They can do everything from scratch, yeah. And as I can. It's very time consuming, though. So, you know, and I don't know, this would be for like people listening to this. Your talents, I'm like speaking to future composers, mm-hmm. your talents may be in like writing a melody, mm-hmm. but you don't know how to do the transition properly. Yeah. So you have to work with an arranger that works all that out, works the maybe reharmonize, maybe your melody goes on and then you want to change keys at a certain point. And they can do that with a lot of finesse and grace. And then you give it to someone who orchestrates it for all the instruments, you know, and then, so you're still a composer, but you've had these people bring it to its realization. So, anyways, I used to probably about for a period of 3 years, I would call him like every 4 months or something like that. Just tell him where, and he would tell me, you want to do this, that, do that. And you make sure when you go to, you know, like an ASCAP dinner or like some industry thing, make sure, it's really important that, like, you introduce a guy and there's his wife there, especially his wife is very pretty. Concentrate on the guy you're talking to and, you know, and be just polite to him, because there are some people that are very, you don't know what, when you get down to brass tacks, you don't know what pisses people off.
Yeah.
And you could do something that completely alienates you from someone that you'll never recover from, you know. So he said basically you got to shut up and listen to people more than talk, opposite where I'm doing right now, which is blabbing my head off. But that was a big deal for me,
yeah.
Because I, out of nervousness as a young kid, I would just wouldn't shut up. And then people will say, I'm going to go over here where you're not, yeah. You know, that kind of thing. So I really appreciate that sort of stuff from him. But anyway, so that's how I got to work on Little House on the Prairie. Wonderful World of Disney, that has like a diagram of people that I met that led me to that. And that was quite by accident, almost, because I was working for Disney through other filmmakers. And then when a big opportunity like the Wonderful World of Disney came, friends of mine that were working with a creative team, I said, hey, can we, you know, put me into the deal of doing the theming? And of course, no one wants to take a risk, right? Well, I don't know. What if you don't do it right? I've been doing this for a while. What do you mean I'm only going to do it right? And you know, so-and-so and so-and-so, which is in the Disney family, they're already bidding for it. I go, well, just put me in too. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, you know? And so luckily, I made it past that. And the funniest thing is what was the determination is that they were going to flip a coin, because they all sounded pretty good. So they gave it to a focus group, and the focus group said the other two things sound too much like Christmas music, and this one sounds like Disneyland. Yeah. And so that was mine.
Yeah.
So they did like a blind test. I don't know what it cost them to do that, but sometimes that happens, you know. So I got that, and so that's how that happened. A lot of it's through diligence, and you have to be prepared. Even people you know that are friends, sometimes they're like, oh, I don't know if I want to take you on board. What if you don't do it right? Well, what if I do it right? Mm-hmm. And here's what was funny, is because I got picked by, a focus group, which who knows where it was, you know, who knows where there's like agencies that take care of that, yeah. You know, and then it comes back. Oh, well, now you're validated. Now we can say, oh yeah, we always thought that John, you know, now everyone wants to take credit for it. Right. So, that's how that kind of got the gears going.
So you worked yourself through different television credits and different things. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you've answered this question, man. How did Killer Clowns end up coming your way?
Oh, okay. Well, here's my thing. This may be a bit too gushy for you, but Killer Clowns was really born out of love and compassion. I had a producer I worked with who was doing very well in the early 80s, and we worked on a lot of projects together. And all of a sudden, he hit a wall, and he needed someone to bunk out with for a while. And he was a very industrious guy, very brilliant guy, always read, very literate, and he would go to the library every day. He stayed at my apartment, but he would always be at the library reading and researching and things like that. And one day, he comes back with, like, out of the Hollywood Reporter, he had torn out a little ad, you know, it was like, it's not Craigslist, right? And he says, hey, there's a guy in Washington, D.C. that's working on a movie. He wants a composer that lives in Hollywood to do his score, and he's doing a short film. So I looked at the address, and I just filled out, sent my resume and a tape. He said it was H.P. Lovecraft story, you know, which was like, who's like Edgar Allan Poe. So I said, oh, I think I have some music that's in that vein. And so 3 weeks later, I got a call from this guy who said, okay, I love your music. And he had a budget for a little orchestra and everything. It was really great. Yeah. And then, so that guy, his name is Eric Young. He teaches at Chapman University now. But he said that... we made such good friends that he said, you know, literally like 5 months later, he said, I work with these two guys in D.C. and in New York and in Philadelphia. They're in L.A. now. They're called the Kyoto Brothers, and they're working on this movie that you probably don't want to do, but it's like a legit movie that's going to be in the theaters and stuff. And but if you might be interested, it's called like Clowns from Outer Space, you know, Invasion of Killer Clowns or something like that.
Yeah.
I go, what are you kidding? Of course. That sounds so bizarre. Because at the time, around that time, Tim Burton was doing crazy stuff, and I liked that genre, and this sounded like it was in that genre. So I called, that's how I got the Kyoto Brothers. So I had to audition just like everyone else, and there was a screening at Warner Brothers, and at that screening, the movie was all cut together, ready to go, but had no music on it. It was actually really creepy without any music.
Oh gosh, I can imagine that movie.
Yeah, it was really like bizarre, because all of a sudden this creepy clown, it was actually kind of scary. And I thought, this is very stylized. It actually had a kind of noir look to it, you know. And yeah. So there was like a good 30 composers in the room.
Oh wow.
Some of them, in personal conversations, I tell the other names and the other composers, and I talk about that day, but I don't need to say it. But yeah, they're guys that we're all still doing
stuff. No, I know yeah, with Hollywood stuff, like a lot of people don't want to reveal who was also
there. It just,
for and it just happened.
And so the I figured I picked a scene that had a lot going on. It's if we're talking about Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and specifically. It's when the boyfriend and girlfriend decide that they're going to venture in the forest to see where the comet landed, and they see the circus tent. Yeah. All right, so we got the discovery. Then they go in the tent, and then they find out that it's not really a circus tent. And then they find out that in the circus tent there are clowns, and there are clowns that are chasing after them, and they have to run away. And then there's the invasion of the town. Basically, boom, we have a cornerstone, or a keystone. It's a keystone moment in the movie, and it has so many change-ups in it. Mm-hmm. I said, that's what I'm going to do, because that seems the most fun to do. Not to pick a scene where like one thing is happening within that 2 minutes or 1 minute or what have you. So I did that, and I decided to just keep it very serious. And I had not gotten the instructions from the Kyoto Brothers yet that they like the movies to King Kong and Mighty Joe Young and you know, The Thing, the original The Thing movie.
Yeah.
And they love the music of classic Hollywood, you know. And so that's what I did, you know.
That was going to be one of the questions I asked you, was like, how did, you know, did they have a specific sound?
Yeah,
not
then
to go off the question that he
asked. Well, that's it. So I thought, oh, we'll just do this with an orchestra, no problem, because they had a pretty good budget. And they said, no, don't want to use an orchestra. I want to pretend you're using an orchestra, but use all the synthesizers to come up with really interesting colors.
Yeah.
And I go, okay, that's a challenge. You know, that's like something I can do, you know, something I can dig my teeth into. And especially Charlie. He was very concerned. I don't want it to sound like an orchestra. I just do not want it to sound like an orchestra. And I found out later, if you see some of his original storyboards, they're done on black paper. With the coloring, because he wanted all the light source to kind of come from the bottom to make everything really creepy throughout the whole movie, and somehow it developed where it was just like very stark, where everything was just lit up. Everything was like the way it is, you see it now.
Yeah.
But if you see his artistic renderings of scenes, they're actually really creepy and really cool, and it'd be neat, that if ever anything developed, that they would take some of that approach too, you know. So, but he was very adamant about it, as were the, and the Kyoto Brothers, very interesting about the Kyoto Brothers, besides the fact that they're all very brilliant and very imaginative and very articulate, is that they all kind of speak together as a group, and it's like they come to one consensus.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they all know, they, as a group, they know what direction they're going to, and you never see any conflict.
Disagreements
of,
or anything.
Well, it's just like they just know what they want.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah.
They know the ultimate goal. It's just a matter of, like, getting there.
Yeah.
You know, so... Anyways, that's how I got to work with them.
Does it, you know, for myself, and I think Clint too, we discovered it because it played on HBO all the time. And, and I mean, I would flip the channel and there it would be. And there, and that's how I discovered the film. And are you amazed, or how do you feel? Like, I mean, obviously at the time it did, it didn't do the greatest. It did like, okay, it wasn't, but it's gone on to become this cult thing that I think more people know about it now than than 30 years ago, and now to the point that, you know, that you, they had a new release of it, you've had the soundtrack come out and all these things that didn't happen way back when. How does it make you feel? Because I mean, you've gone on, you've done a ton of more TV, some more movies. You, I mean, you were also involved with another cult classic, The Wizard of Speed and Time. Here we are 30 years later, and how does
it's
it make...
It's kind of come to fruition.
Is it weird that something you did that long ago has sort of become, like, it's... I mean, I guess for any film composer, it's got to be... If you can have one movie that people, boom, remember, and I mean, how does it make you feel here we are 30 years later, we're still talking about this, and it's actually probably more popular now than it ever was before.
Well, it feels really good. I'm not going to lie to you. It's really heartwarming. I should say feel good. It's really heartwarming to me to see, you know, for instance, at the Halloween Horror Nights where they have a scare zone in Orlando, Florida, to see a little child who took her first steps. You know, her parents came there and first steps toward a killer clowns and hugged him. It almost brings me to tears. It's really lovely. At the time, we were very realistic. I realized not everyone is going to get this. And how did I know everyone is not going to get this? Because before it was released, several things happened. I took the music by itself to my grandmother. Always played stuff to my grandmother, and this was one of the last scores she heard. Oh, now, wow. figure, 8 months prior to this, she had heard the Wonderful World of Disney theme, and she was spinning. She was, "Oh, John, this is so wonderful! I always knew that you would. You know, you're always practicing the piano. You're always playing music. You do the concerts at college, and I knew something wonderful would happen." She wanted me to be the music director for the Merv Griffin show. Oh. I said, "I don't know, Grandma. I'm not. I met Merv Griffin, and I told him that my grandmother Laura just loves you, and he says say hi to you. But I don't think I can do that." But Merv Griffin was like a local, kind of like Johnny Carson. He was like another Johnny Carson.
Yeah, but he was on like on the daytime.
Yeah, he was in the daytime, and he had sometimes it was like in the early evening.
Yeah,
sometimes.
I remember my grandmother used to watch.
Yeah,
used to watch.
So. But the fact that it did The Wonderful World of Disney, and we lived in a part of Orange County that was very close to Disneyland, right? And so Disney was very close. The whole persona of Disney was very close to me. So she heard that, and she was just beaming. So I played this Killer Clowns. I didn't tell her what it was. Mm-hmm. And there's some scenes in Killer Clowns that are, like, very colorful and emotional, especially when they first come to the magical space tent. It's like mysterious, but yet beautiful, but yet what is it kind of thing. And she would listen to this music. She goes, "Oh, my goodness, that's so beautiful. That's so wonderful. I love this. What is it for, John?" "Well, it's for a science fiction movie." "Oh, that's nice." She's thinking, like, who knows? Like,
who knows what?
Yeah. And
she's not thinking Killer Clowns.
"No, what's the name of it?" And I said, "Well, it's Killer Clowns from Outer Space." "You have to change the name. This music's too beautiful to be called that, you know." So anyways, but I was very realistic because, like, my parents, my dad, they didn't like it.
Yeah.
I think they didn't like it because they just didn't like the name.
Yeah.
you know. And then friends of mine went to see it. Some people got it and it's like, oh, this is so bizarre, this is so great. Now at the studio that produced it, the music director, he said, you know, I see this movie. He was a very brilliant man, Bob Hunka. He worked at Transworld, and then he went on to work at Sony Pictures as a music director there. Very insightful guy, very, very talented. He says, you know what? This is going to be like Buckaroo Banzai. Buckaroo Banzai didn't do well in the theaters. Brilliant, imaginative movie. Had a beautiful life in and that's where you're going to find out in cable and this new thing called rental, you know, movie rentals. You know, well, it was still in its infancy. Yeah, it's still in its like third or fourth year by that time.
Yeah.
Whereas like, I remember VHS, you know, they used to charge $10 a night, but your entire family can watch it. You can watch it multiple times.
Yeah.
Imagine that it's $10. Now it's like, you know, what a stream service. You can buy music for $10.
Or stream it much less than that.
But anyways, so we were realistic about it. And there was a weird timing thing in that there were two respectable journalists that reviewed it. I forgot the one that for the LA Times, but for the LA Weekly was Jonathan Gold, who won so many awards with his movie reviews, restaurant reviews, and theater reviews. He just passed away, unfortunately. I happened to go to school with him too, and sadly he passed away. But anyways, they all gave great reviews that got published on the Monday after the first, you know, after it was released in theaters, and it didn't register with. You know, so people came to the wanted to come to the theater on the following Thursday and Friday, but the movie had been pulled.
Yeah.
So it's like, where's that clown movie I wanted to see?
Yeah.
So it was just like one of those weird timing things.
Yeah.
But because I think it had to make its tour around the country, so it there was a certain amount of prints in certain cities like Seattle, San Francisco, and L.A. and San Diego. Then it went to the Midwest. Then it went to the East Coast, and somehow it's not like today where we have blogs and YouTube reviews and what have you.
Yeah.
We're even though print and we just didn't have the internet. There was no way to spread it like wildfire. It would take another week and a half for it to get to the good news to get to the East Coast.
Yeah.
This is a crazy little movie, and I did whacked out things. I'm going to tell you, it's like stalker things. I would call theaters in Chicago because I believed in the movie. Call theaters in Chicago. Hi, I understand you're playing a movie called, that's a rather odd name. My children seem interested in it. It's Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Yes. Is this a terrifying movie with my children? Oh, no, it's not terrifying at all. Oh, what kind of movie is it? Oh, it's bizarre. It's weird. Well, I have a 7-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 15-year-old. Well, let me see. Maybe 11-year-old and 15-year-old. The 7-year-old might get scared out of it, but it's not. It's not like it's really creepy. There's no really gory scenes. It's just weird. So, is it funny? Some people laugh during the movie. Oh, wait, thank you. And I'd probably call in Atlanta when I found out wherever the hell it was playing.
Yeah.
I would call just to do that, and I don't know if they had any. I don't know. That's like that's like doing an email blast like today. What would that be like? It's like stalking something on the internet. It's like overposting something.
Like a newsletter.
It was like a news. I don't know.
Newsletter blast.
But I would call the theater and talk to like the manager.
Yeah.
As a concerned parent, you know, how crazy is that? That's insane. So it made its run, and then it was quiet. Nothing happened after that. I did some like bizarre little movies. There was a series of movies I did with Lorenzo Lamas, who was like doing the equivalent of what's the movie with the movie with Mel Gibson and Danny Glover.
Oh, Lethal Weapon.
Okay,
Lethal Weapon.
They were like,
so he did,
the low budget Lethal Weapon, and he always had a different Canadian actor for each of the movie that he was buddies with to do things, and you know, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun doing those movies, And they were produced by Michael Pasternak, who founded Lionsgate afterwards. So I like did things like that and various other. There was a TV series called Monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
That I did. I did a bunch of those too, and that was a lot of fun. I got the Chiodo brothers on one of the episodes. They needed a dinosaur.
That's cool.
And they had the best dinosaur you could ever get for whatever budget they had. So anyways, so it didn't happen. It didn't start peaking until like 1994. Then it started. And the only way I knew, because I wasn't really a cable nut.
Yeah.
The only way I knew is by residuals I would get. Oh, it must be playing a lot. Like everywhere, all over the world. And then little by little, it's grown. It's become part of American culture in a certain way. Because there would be people that would, like I would meet, and we would work on a project. Had nothing to do with sci-fi. It could be a commercial. See, you know, I looked up, this is like in the mid-90s when IMDb started coming out. Like, let me see, 95, 96. And they said, I looked up, you did that Killer Clowns from Outer Space movie. I love that movie. You know, and it's like, that's how, you know, and it's like, I'm working for people today. On a project that has nothing to do with Killer Clowns from Outer Space. It's a virtual reality video game.
Yeah.
They don't know from Killer Clowns from anything. Yeah. They know I'm right for their project. I worked on another VR movie, a biblical story, the story of Jesus Christ. They didn't hire me because I did Killer Clowns from Outer Space. You know, as a matter of fact, they would have to dig deep to find that, because they were looking more at, Disney, Little House on the Prairie, and then some other series. Ray Bradbury Theater.
Yeah.
I did the Ray Bradbury Theater. They, you know, that registered with them. That's what they picked up on. Their probably eyes just glossed over the whole Killer Clowns thing, you know. So, but yeah, it's really nice. The wonderful thing about Killer Clowns is it's a fun movie, and it's bizarre. It's got a sense of humor. Got a sense of wonderment, a sense of definitely bizarreness, and a sense of humor. I already said that, comedy, and it has enough gore and weird sci-fi aspect to it that that's what makes it appealing. It has a multi-dimension to it, and I think it's colorful. If you ask me, I think subliminally, the colors that Charlie and the Kyoto's set up on the set. You know, I saw some YouTuber review it. It says, look, when all these clowns walk across the screen with the designs of their costume against the backdrop, there's like, he's talked about how things match up, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's all Charlie and Steve and Edward.
You can see that in the Scare Zone, too, Halloween Horror Nights. The colors, the lighting.
Yes, everything works out. You know. Oh, the color. I understand that the colors match the movie. They got the color scheme right.
Yeah, what was it like, and you sort of touched on it earlier, but what was it like to walk around that corner the other night to see that, to hear your score being played
in a theme park
at an event, and people we obviously follow social media, people have gone crazy over the zone.
People who I don't know that said they go. Obviously, they're locals. They go every night because it's just so fun to hang out there. Well, what was my impression? When I first was across the... There's like a lagoon kind of thing. Yeah. I was across the way. I just wanted to look at it for a few minutes. I love the shadow show thing. And it was like, wow, these people put a lot... Because I talked to the creative people, Michael Aiello, and they love the movie. And they've been fighting to do this for the longest time. And they really, you could just tell they really studied the movie backwards and forwards. You know, it's interesting how they focused on, they got the shadow puppet show. They've got the colors right. They did a nice cheat for the spaceship, you know, because they couldn't get a spaceship in this year. But they could get an ice cream truck. And they got the two actors, which were were hilarious. And they got the clowns right. So my impression, I felt like a little kid again. Mm-hmm. I felt like a little kid. And I just wanted to enjoy it. Just like everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I got to take some group shots with some of the clowns and interact with them. Like a person who, like a fan would, almost. Mm-hmm. You know, I got to tell the Terenzi brothers that, you know, this is just some scam they cooked up to sell ice cream and get girls with that with that damn rented ice cream truck. You know, it was just fun to say that, yeah. You know. And I just wanted to I just had fun with it. Just and yeah, and that's where I met the family with the little girl just happened to be there that took her first steps like a few weeks ago, and she likes clowns. When she sees them, she's so there's another generation, you know. So there's grandchildren and great grandchildren that grown up with this, and it's you know, and I think we the Kyoto brothers and I talked about this. It's, for some people, it's kind of like comfort food. Every once in a while, they haul out killer clowns from outer space and bake up a bunch of macaroni and cheese.
Just to hang out.
I'm going to crack a beer. I had a hard week. I'm going to crack open a beer, and I'm going to watch this. Yeah. You know, which is basically what it's exactly what it's for. It's for people to enjoy, you know.
Yeah.
We weren't trying to, like, make any great social commentary. Actually, the great social commentary is that, you know, a group of guys got to do something completely bizarre that was their own original idea. The interesting thing about the studio, and not everyone agrees with me on this, but the studio was like, it's like from a bygone era, even before the 80s, where a producer says, gosh darn it, I need, you know, with a cigar-chomping producer, I need something different. I need something complete fresh that no one's ever seen. Can you do, what can you give me, boys? Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Sounds great. You write me a couple pages on that. Let me look at that. Yeah, that works. I think we can sell this. Literally said like that. They wrote 3 pages on it. And then they just got to work doing diagrams and what have you and working on the script. And the script, they will tell you, which is kind of a smart way to do it. It's like just like anything. Even in music, there are some symphonic works that are based, modeled after previous symphonic works. Like I remember studying... composition with a composer, and he said, okay, you know Prokofiev's Piano Concerto number, I think it's number 2, yes, it's modeled after Mendelssohn Piano Concerto. It modeled the same way. They don't sound the same, but it's modeled the same way. It has similar form. It has a certain type of introduction. It goes into a certain type of, you know, it makes certain moves that one composer emulated. It's not that he copied the notes. So the Kyoto brothers modeled the Blob. Let's take the Blob and use that as our model. It's like it follows a graph, a diagram of activity. There's the kids. They're at the smooching place. There's something weird that happens. There's someone that discovers the, you know, the spaceship that landed. And little by little, the whole town is in disarray. And you have comic relief, and you have the straight man, and you have that's what they did. You know, let's just take something that worked and model our thing. But it's not like they were copying the Blob. They said, well, we'll just make those script moves that the Blob took. And that was smart. So they went from... someone just saying, give me a new idea, fresh new idea no one's ever heard of. Yes, let's do that. That's what happened.
Awesome. Thanks for sitting down with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks.
And I'm loving Florida. But I have to leave tomorrow. I'm really sorry.
Yeah. Well, come back.
I will.
Come back. Thanks.
All right. So there you have it. That's episode 50 of the Thrill Geek podcast. Perfect timing for John Mazzari to come down to the Orlando area, as Barry was saying at the beginning, and chat with us about his career, and in particular, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. And also huge thanks to Johnny Brano coming on and chatting with us about all things haunt, because perfectly enough, episode 50 of our podcast falls on Halloween week. So it's perfect.
So. Yeah, I mean, we got one more week of Halloween basically here in Orlando, and needless to say, we will be cramming in as much Halloween Horror Nights as we can here towards the end. It's hard to believe it's going to be over with. And speaking of Halloween Horror Nights, the next episode, we are going to do our recap of Halloween Horror Nights 28. And we are finally going to give our top houses, our top scare zones, and our overall thoughts for 28. And we've got a special announcement next week, because coming this December, Thrill Geek's going to go where it's never gone before. And we'll leave that.
We'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Actually, I haven't even told Clint about this, so.
No, you haven't. That's why I'm like, what's going on?
But we'll tell you. We'll announce it next week on the podcast. All we'll say is Thrill Geeks going where it's never gone before.
Suspense.
Yes. So remember, follow us at Thrill Geek on Twitter and Instagram. Facebook.com/ThrillGeek. Please like and follow our Facebook page, and that's where you'll see most of our live streams. And don't forget, YouTube.com/ThrillGeek. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. We've got all kinds of Halloween haunt stuff, from Hallow Scream to Halloween Horror Nights, everything Halloween. We've got it on the YouTube channel. And, of course, ThrillGeek.com for the latest in theme park and pop culture news. And, of course, you're listening to the Thrill Geek podcast, available wherever podcasts are sold. But you don't have to pay for ours, so it's free. So I don't know why I said that. But that's it.
Yeah. Once again, thank you, guys. Episode 50. Here's to 50 more. I can't believe we've come this far. I'm not going to sit here and reminisce about the past 50 episodes. But both me and Barry have come a long ways with, you know, how we've carried ourselves and how we've presented ourselves with this podcast, getting a little more comfortable with every episode we've done. So
yes, we've reduced ums and yes by 50%.
So, you know, really thank you guys for downloading and listening to us. I think we just announced a little while ago we're past 10,000 downloads. I don't know where we are right now, but
I think 12,000.
Yeah, but to me, numbers really don't matter. I mean, they're nice to look at, but your guys' continued support is what really matters to me, and that you guys continue to listen. So thank you guys again, and we will see you guys on the next episode.
See you in the parks.